Welcome to Smart Water Solutions Podcast. I am Hakim El-Fadil. This is episode number 53. Today I have with me Greg Newblom, the founder and CEO of Membrion. This is very innovative company that they have developed ceramic membrane. They move it from a lab scale to industrial scale. It took them a journey to really upscale this membrane. So in this episode, we are going to dive into this journey and the applications that they are targeting with this ion exchange ceramic membrane and the value of it. And the most important thing is the capex of making this membrane compared to the conventional ceramic membrane. And also the operation and cost of using this membrane compared to the conventional polymeric membrane when it comes to treating harsh industrial wastewater. So, I mean, one of the questions that I have going through your career, which is you have been in academia and then you could have stayed in academia. It's very good, accomplishments that you have accomplished so far. And would you just walk us through your achievements in academia and then at the point where you decide to move from academia to the industry?
Sure. Yeah. So I, certainly was very fortunate to have great mentors while I was in academia, which helped a lot with the successes that were there. So yeah, I have a handful of publications, I think five first author publications. I've got, you know, a little bit more than 300 citations on those. Another five with collaborators, first author on a textbook chapter that's out there on neutron scattering, which is my background. That's a whole other subject in and of itself. A dozen or so patents during my time in grad school, a few dozen conferences and some different awards and things like that throughout the process. But I think, as with the Membrion, which I'm sure we'll talk about more later, it's always the team and the people that you have around you. So I have great mentors, great collaborators, and that really facilitated the successes that were there.
Right. And what was the motivation or the inspiration that you decide? Because you easily could have done very good career in academia. I mean, very well-known professors, but you decide to jump in the industry. So what was the trigger?
Yeah, I've really always been drawn to the practical application side. You know, I can do the fundamental things, and there's a lot of fun in just, exploring and thinking. And it's very, academia is in a lot of ways very artistic, if you will, right? You get to just explore different ideas and see where they go and learn new things and expand the knowledge frontier. But there's this disconnect often with, how, like, practical solutions to real world problems. Often the things that are worked on in academia are so abstract that they will never actually make it to help the people that they're intending. And so, so I really wanted to actually have that impact and really be able to move those technical skills into something that, that had the ability to do some good, in the world. And so I think that's a big part of it for me in making that transition.
Right, and the transition was with ceramic membrane that you have developed in academia.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that is what we took forward. Absolutely.
Yeah, would be great if you can walk us through. I mean, the name, really, I like it, which is Membrion. Yeah. I mean, could you maybe, you are better than me to talk about how you pick up the name and what is behind this name as a product.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I first started the company, we actually didn't start with Membrion. Interestingly enough, we started with ionic windows because we make these glass that do desalination and they move ions. And so it was glass, windows, ions. It seemed like a good fit, but ultimately we landed on Membrion about a year in, where we changed the name of the company, really with the idea that it's just a lot more immediately recognizable what we're doing. We make a membrane, it moves ions. And the thing that makes us unique is the fact that we're the only ceramic membrane that can run a desalination process. And so so that's really where we're making our impact.
Right. And so when you develop this, ceramic membrane, so water is huge. So when we talk about water, it's you have wastewater, you have seawater, and also you can break down wastewater, the brackish water, industrial. So which applications you are focusing right now with your product, and what is the portfolio that you have in hand right now?
Yeah, so we work with a lot of different clients across different industries. I'd say the linking theme between the people we're working with is really that they have extreme or harsh wastewaters. They're wastewaters that typically you can't use an existing membrane technology with. And so the facilities we work with, they're trucking their wastewater offsite, they're boiling it, they're using single-use adsorption materials. They're doing these really legacy processes. And so what we're doing is helping to basically take those same streams and being able to treat them in a much more energy efficient, much more cost effective way that generates more clean water on the back end. And so, you know, I think that some of the areas we've seen a lot of success are areas like heavy metal wastewater, which show up in semiconductor and automotive and mining and a handful of other industries as well. You know, work with a lot of brines that otherwise are very tough to treat, you know, heavy in organics and scalants and things like that, that are just particularly well suited for our membranes. But where we like to play is really in the space of things that no other membrane can handle adequately. And so it's these really extreme wastewaters that get us excited and generally are the ones that get our customers excited as well.
Right. And before getting to how you fix or how you treat that wastewater, I mean, would you just break down the components of your technology? Is it anionic, cationic? How does it work in practice?
Yeah, absolutely. So the technology itself is it's a ceramic membrane. It has nano porosity in it, meaning that it's about 1/10,000th the thickness of a human hair, is the size of our pores, about 1.5 nanometers wide. And we have chemical functional groups that are bound to the surface of that, and they make it either a positively charged membrane or a negatively charged membrane. And we use those two membranes together to run a desalination process, because we can move different charges of ions across different membranes into a separate stream. And so that's really how the technology works, but it's all bound to these silica nanoporous structure is really the backbone of what provides all the durability in this system.
Right. And I mean, as far as I know, whenever we go to the academia, also the industry, ceramic membrane, most of the time, they're very expensive compared to polymeric membrane.
Yeah.
They're very good. They're reliable. Sure. But they're very expensive. I mean, if you're a company in Germany, it's very expensive. Whenever I get this request, this is where polymeric membrane really beats the ceramic.
Yep.
So looking to your technology, it's kind of different. Would you comment on this point?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very different. So yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon for, you know, the kind of rough order of magnitude is, you know, polymer membranes about $10 per meter squared ish, and ceramics are often more than $1,000 per meter squared, right? So 100 times more expensive than the polymers. And really, what we're doing is we're the first ones that are manufacturing ceramics roll to roll. So we're doing a roll to roll production process. It's all done at room temperature, which is very unique. Everyone else that makes a ceramic membrane uses it in the crystalline phase. You know, ceramics have different bonding structures. And so they use it in order to get that crystalline phase, which makes it really capable of handling a lot of these really extreme environments and high pressures in particular. They take it up to, you know, 1200 degrees Celsius. They sinter it and calcinate it, and that makes it very rigid, very easy to break also. But what we do is, we, by processing everything at room temperature, we keep our ceramics in the amorphous phase. And so by keeping them in the amorphous phase, they're very flexible. You can actually take our membranes and wrap it around your finger and unwrap it and load it into a module, and it'll work just fine. And we are, you know, in that way, it's also because we can make in using mass production, you know, we're producing hundreds of a meter squared a day now. We're able to keep them much more cost effective, because ceramics are not expensive. If you think about it, right, we make our membranes out of sand. It's one of the most abundant materials in the world. So it's all commodity chemicals, and ceramic membranes historically have been expensive because you have to heat them so high, and you have to do that in batches. And that's really where our innovation came in, and being able to do this at room temperature, roll to roll. So we will, our final product when it comes out of production line is literally a roll of ceramic membranes with nanoporosity that can run a desalination process. And so that gives us a lot of advantages in that space. Now, if you look at the durability, are we, at 100% of the traditional crystalline? No, but we're at like 70%. And that difference in performance gives us an incredible advantage over polymer membranes because we are still way more durable than polymers, but we're not going to be that same crystalline durability, but we don't need it. In most of the applications that we're in, we can handle these extreme environments just fine, even with that. But a lot of that just came with a different approach, different thinking about how do we use a different phase of the material than people have used in the past.
Right. When you said durability, it's a very interesting point. Polymeric membrane, if we talk about desalination, they could survive easily 7 years. But if you move them to mining, as you said, or to harsh wastewater treatment, then you have oxidants, you have so many stuff that kill the membrane for a short period of time.
That's right.
So if I understand correctly, your membrane is durable for harsh conditions.
That's right. Yeah, and maybe to give you a perspective of what we're talking about with harsh, we've worked on a handful of different copper wastewater projects in the semiconductor industry, and in one of those, we're working with a pH zero wastewater stream. It's got greater than 1% peroxide in the stream. It's got residual solvents in the stream. It's got chelating agents in the stream. Any one of these four things would be problematic for an existing RO membrane, and our membranes did just fine. They're able to handle all of those together, which means that realistically, the result is that you don't have all the pretreatment that's required on the front end in order to be able to remove the copper. And so that's really where, from our standpoint, we can add a lot of value in that we can handle these really complex environments that are way more extreme than a polymer could ever handle. We actually did a side-by-side test where we, dip our membrane and dip a traditional polymer membrane. You can watch the polymer membrane like vigorously boil and bubble and degrade in these environments because it's just, it's not as durable.
Well, I mean, certainly this will make you, I mean, access to untapped market, like for instance, battery. So there's extreme pH condition. I mean, recently, with Ivo van Kerkhove here group in Belgium, so they're searching for a specific membrane to replace Nafion because it's one membrane that's killing the market. And I think I see it somewhere in your homepage also, you're competing against Nafion. So before getting to that point, so this product, it was a baby in the lab at the university. Okay.
It was.
To upscale it's not easy task, I would say.
No,
So,
definitely not.
exactly. So we're struggling also here with epoxy membrane to upscale it. It's a lot of stuff going on. So, but in your case, it's very interesting because you don't need extreme temperature condition or anything to really produce it. So would you just pinpoint which kind of challenges that you faced while upscaling this product?
Yeah, we certainly, there have been a lot of challenges along the way with getting it scaled up. Because, when we were making it originally, we made them, by hand about the size of a quarter. So they're very small and they showed good performance. And now we're making stuff that's almost a meter wide and hundreds of meters long. And so that process, that was a 6-year process to get us from that point to the next. So it was not by any means trivial. There were tons of hurdles throughout the way to be able to get it from one stage to the next, and even just getting the consistency, because for desalination you have to have that sub nanometer pore size and control. And so that's for us, as we're looking at how do you make something that is uniform across a meter wide that is has nanometer precision the whole way through. Because if you don't, that's a pinhole, and you're not going to desalinate properly. And so getting that level of control was very complicated and took a lot of work by a lot of really brilliant people on my team to be able to get that to work. But yeah, I mean, there was lots of things, even from scaling up the chemical reactions that we do, to making sure that the coatings were uniform across the width of the membrane, to controlling the pore size. And that doesn't even cover the post-processing when you actually put it into a module and all those other sorts of things. It's, you know, there's been hundreds of different challenges to overcome. And thankfully we've been able to overcome everyone that's come our way, which is why we're here today.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, when you say 6 years, I was always thinking about, in terms of investments, I mean, there must be good investors, really, they wait for the 6 years. And when I was looking, it's in Seattle, and then looking to Seattle is like a capital, kind of capital of IT startup. So it's not like hardware. So how do you compete against those IT to get the funding?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, you're right. If we look around in Seattle, there's not many companies that are doing what we're doing, kind of manufacturing, hard tech, deep tech type endeavors. And I think, we do have phenomenal investors, and they've been patient. You know, they've known it's going to take time and effort. And but I think that a lot of that comes down to, you know, for us, we're not marginally better than the competition, right? We're not a 10% improvement over the state of the art. You know, we're a 100x improvement over the state of the art. And so that helps people to say, like, it's going to take time. It's going to take time to figure it out. No one's ever done it before. And so, you know, we really, from our investor standpoint, the pressure is on getting the right people on the team, because that's what's going to dictate the length of time it takes to move it forward. But yeah, phenomenal investors and people who have been very successful in business and tech and engineering, that know we need solutions to water problems. We know we need to solve these problems that are coming, and see this really as a way to do that.
Yeah. And have you think about, or have you been approached by the big fishes, like, Dow, Hydronautics, Toray? Because, I mean, those guys, they have supply chain and they have infrastructure to upscale the membrane for more than 3 decades. So they have so much know-how. So it would be not 6 years for them, but maybe shorter than that. So have you been approached by those big guys, because they have also big capacity to produce for the market, because the market is so big? I have no idea what is your capacity to produce per month, but the market is so big. So have you been approached by those, or have you been thinking to kind of merge or do some cooperation with them to bring your product to the market?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that we've had lots of conversations with different people. You know, one of the big challenges is that the production process, even though it's roll to roll, is very different than a polymer. The way we're doing it's very different. And so we did, you know, initially that was actually one of our strategies. Hey, could we find the right partner that already has this infrastructure in place? And basically what we found is there was no one that had something that we could just say, hey, make this, because, you know, ceramics behave differently. They're very rigid relative to polymers, and they have their own unique challenges. And so, we were able, thankfully, to use off the shelf equipment to make these. But every manufacturer we talk to, one of the comments that we get from people is like, well, you could use it like that, but no one does. So we have a bunch of off the shelf standard stuff, using it in ways that no one uses it, but works for us. And so that's, I think, one of the keys from an innovation standpoint. It's not just the chemistry of the materials. It's been my team innovating even on the way that these things are manufactured in very non-traditional ways. But that's what's required, because no one else is making roll to roll ceramics. That's a brand new class of materials. And so there wasn't a standard playbook that we could just go to an existing membrane person and say, hey, use what you got. They all said, like, you know, roll to roll ceramics, like, how do you do that? And we were like, well, we don't know. Hopefully we thought you'd be able to tell us. And we just had to figure it out ourselves. So,
I mean, the first time when I saw your membrane, it's like, really, you can, it's very flexible. I was thinking it's a hybrid membrane, but actually it's not a hybrid membrane. It's It's ceramic membrane.
It's ceramic. We can, so we do use a mechanical support with it, and we can use that. We can make that out of lots of different materials. You know, we can do fully ceramic where it's all glass. It's still very flexible. You can get, you know, flexible non-woven glasses, for example. We can make it on cellulose, like paper. We can make it on polymers. And so we basically, you know, we've got some standard materials that we use to give us broad applicability across applications. But sometimes you need, you know, the ceramics, for example, are great under a lot of conditions. But you could imagine that if you use cellulose, that's going to degrade in a lot of conditions. And so we have to have the right pairing between that mechanical support and the ceramic material itself. So, but we do use both. And sometimes it is helpful to have that a polymer in there to even increase the flexibility further.
Excellent. Okay, so you also can add a polymer to add to.
Yeah, we can have the mechanical support can be not like a non-woven polymer or an expanded polymer. Are strategies that can add more flexibility.
Okay, so basically, you have more flexibility to design different module than pure ceramic membrane
because they don't have
flexibility like
your exactly thing. because they have to take it up to such high temperatures that they don't have the flexibility there, where for us we can use lots of different support materials you know that each have their own unique advantages and disadvantages.
Yeah, I mean the aha moment when I was looking also to your patent and then your articles, which is the raw materials, it's abundant.
Yes, yep, it is.
Yeah, the process is not hugely expensive in terms of energy and also chemicals.
Yep, exactly. But,
yeah, I think the most difficult thing here is the 6 years that you put to upscale.
Yes, exactly. Yep. No, that's been the most challenging part is getting it from that laboratory bench and really from an idea, right? Because that's where it all started, to then even getting it from an idea to working on the laboratory bench and then let alone mass production. And so even now, you know, I think our capacity for production is, you know, upwards of like 10,000 meters squared a year. But the nice thing is at this point, scaling up from that is not overly challenging because it's just a lot of duplication of equipment and things like that. So it's actually fairly easy to continue increasing from there.
Right. I mean, I remember one time when I was, work in the past, I was discussing with someone. I said, okay, we cannot produce this membrane. I need it for my customer. Can we ask another company to do it for us and give them the recipe? He said, it's not about the recipe. It's about how to produce this membrane. It takes a lot of time, you know, to have a qualified team to produce that recipe. That's definitely.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the big things when, especially, you know, when investors talk to us and they'll ask about, is it patented? Do you have a patent? I'm like, yes, absolutely. Like we do have it patented. We have issued patents. They protect our chemistry, but that's not the hardest part. The hardest part is actually being, even if you could read our patents, getting from that patent to our product requires deep expertise. And those are the people that we've hired. You know, they're on our team and replicating that would be incredibly difficult.
Yeah. And even to, that's one thing also to have a high yield. That's also difficult to have high yield. I mean,
exactly. Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's move on to the applications. I mean, can you pick up, you can start with me with the one by one applications and then explain how the mechanism work with your membrane. And then, and also I would like to learn about how your technology is competing against existing or conventional membrane in terms of CapEx and OpEx.
Sure. Yeah. So maybe I'll go back to that semiconductor wastewater that I was mentioning. So copper wastewater is a very common waste stream in semiconductor manufacturing, coming out of the back end of fabs for microelectronics. You know, that water is, there's a variety of different treatment solutions for that, that people are using. I think historically, treatment was largely driven by chemical precipitation of copper. You do the pH adjustment, it precipitates out, and then you deal with the copper sludge on the back end. A lot of facilities have moved away from that over the last decade or so. I'd say current state of the art that people are leveraging are things like concentrated copper is often processed with electrowinners, is a way to deal with those. You know, some facilities truck them offsite and have it electrowon or evaporated. And single-use ion exchange resins that are copper selective is another one. And so, you know, when we're working with facilities, all of those methods are very expensive. We're talking, and really what we're looking at is the OPEX for the facility, right? What are they paying every single year to deal with this copper wastewater? And it's very common to see something in the range of $2 to $4 million annually spent on treating copper wastewater using these existing methods. And so what we do is when we approach the facility, we aren't asking them to get rid of their existing equipment. We actually work with their existing equipment to enhance the efficiency. So for example, it's very common to see a copper and a segregated wastewater stream at especially large semiconductor facilities. And so we can work with the concentrated copper to help reduce the volume that you send either to an electrowinner or to a trucking process. And that saves money from an electricity or a hauling expense. And we'll work with the dilute wastewater, which is commonly treated with technology to reduce the amount of copper that goes to that resin. And that's usually something that we can reduce by 10 to 15x the amount of resin that goes to the copper or to the copper that goes to the resin. And so you spend a lot less on resin costs. And then we send our concentrate stream over to the concentrate side to be processed there. And so you have to look at kind of net balance of plant on some of those or of a process for those two streams, but it's very common for us to see somewhere between $1 to $2 million in annual savings for a facility leveraging our tech. And generally a kind of 18 month to 2 year ROI in installing our system. And the advantage of doing it that way is that we minimize their risk, right? Because that's the biggest thing that we get. Brand new technology, right? Ceramic desalination, super cool, but does it work? Is it going to last forever? And so, you know, telling them, hey, replace your existing process with us, that's a huge ask, right? But asking them, hey, keep your existing process, but we will make it way more efficient. We will reduce your OPEX. We'll cut it in half for what you're spending to treat this water. Well, that's really interesting because the risk is very low. Even if we aren't successful, we are, but even if we weren't, they can still use their existing equipment. They can still go back to their existing process. And so all they're counting on us to do is help to make that process more efficient than it is today by adjusting the concentrations into the ranges that matter most. Because the reality is electrowinners, or even, you know, if you're going to truck it offsite, the higher the concentration, the lower the volume, the more efficient it is. For resins, the lower the concentration, the more efficient it is. And so all we're doing is saying, hey, you've got these two streams that actually aren't optimized for the concentration ranges you're using. Let us help bring those both into their optimum spots. And in doing that, you can save a couple million dollars a year by optimizing for the existing technologies. And in pretty much all of the projects we're running on, and we can talk through different applications as well, that's what we're doing. We're just helping to align facilities into the optimum ranges that they should be. And we can do that with a membrane technology because we can handle these really harsh environments.
So you mean harsh, it's pH, very low pH.
This pH, pH oxidizers, chelating agents, and residual solvents for semiconductor.
Right. And then the copper is like in the permeates and the rest is concentrated in the retentate.
Exactly. Yep. Yep, exactly.
There is no place for polymeric membrane here.
No, definitely not. Definitely not a situation for a polymeric membrane. You know, one of the big challenges even with these streams is, you know, there's so much peroxide in it often that it's literally bubbling. So getting the right pumps that will actually keep working even with that much entrained gas is challenging. Those are actually the really hard problems for us, is how do you even pump, you know, liquids like this? And thankfully there's a lot of people that know how to do that well. It's very complex wastewater.
Yeah. And then, I mean, membrane, you're able to have cationic and anionic membrane.
Yep. So, exactly.
Right. Would you just, just walk us through them, the process, how they work differently, just for the audience to have an idea, feeling how they work differently. Because
Absolutely.
I never invited someone who talks about kind of trionic and ionic membrane, except one professor. Yeah, can you?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So basically, the way that that an electrodialysis system works, and this is true for kind of all electrodialysis systems, is you have what's called a cell pair, which is a cation exchange membrane and a spacer in between, and then an anion exchange membrane on the other side. And you actually have in a stack or in a module, you might have 100 up to maybe 400 or 500 cell pairs. So you've got a lot of membranes that are in there. And basically what you're doing is you can imagine if you're flowing feed in between those two membranes, you apply an electric field and the cation is going to want to go, right? So you're going to have a positive electrode and your negative ions, your anions are going to want to go towards that electrode and vice versa. And so your membrane is actually ensure that they can pass through. So cations will pass through a cation exchange membrane. Anions will pass through an anion exchange membrane. But because they're alternating, you can imagine that the distance that they can travel is only ever through one membrane, right? So if you have a cation exchange membrane, that cation can go through that membrane, but then the next membrane is going to be an anion exchange membrane. So it's blocked. And so then it will just flow through in that channel. And because they're each moving different directions, what ends up happening is you create basically alternating dilute and concentrate channels in that module, because things are both, they're moving out of one channel and they're moving into another channel. And so that allows you to up concentrate and create basically a brine and a dilute solution on the other side. And so that's really what we're leveraging in all these cases, is just something that is able to pull ions out of that solution.
So basically, I mean, every ion need to have some electricity. You pay for the to move the ions from one side
to
the other.
You have to pay, yeah. And that's actually one of the big things for electrodialysis that's been a challenge historically, is that you pay for every ion you move, right? Because it costs electricity to get it across there. And your membranes, as you can imagine, they because the ion is moving across the membrane, the thicker your membrane is, the more electricity you have to apply to drag that thing across that membrane, because it's got a resistance to it. And that's one of the things that we do that's really unique, because our membranes are ceramic and they don't swell, they don't change shape, unlike other ion exchange membranes. We're able to make them a lot thinner, which make them a lot more energy efficient. So you have to spend less energy moving ions across our membranes than you would a traditional membrane for electrodialysis. And we can actually, we have partners that we work with that we can actually make these things, extremely thin, 10 times thinner than things that are available on the market today, which allow us to then treat really economically things like brines. A lot of the streams that we're working with are, we can treat things that are more like seawater brines, that might come out of a seawater RO. That's something that we can then treat economically with our process.
Yeah. I mean, hold that. I will come to this point, because it's also the core for the water treatment. But let me just stop for the look to the market right now. The products or the membrane, that's a cationic and ionic membrane, we can count them in our hands. There is Nafion from DuPont, there is other Mitsubishi, or only a handful of companies in the world. So comparing your technology with their technology from working principle, how valuable your technique compared to the others?
Yeah, so I would say there's certain things that that are very similar about our membranes. We all move ions, right? So that's something that's similar. I would say that and then there's the looking at kind of the traditional applications, the ones that all of us can do, and then there's the unique ones that only Membrion can tackle. So if you look at the traditional ones, where we do better there is because we can make our membranes thinner. Because our membranes are made ceramic, they're hydrophilic, that helps with reducing fouling and things like that. So we're able to move salt and desalinate using less electricity. We have fewer cleaning cycles that are required in these traditional applications. We're able to, because our membrane surfaces have some texturing to it, it helps to make sure that we're not getting scale build up as frequently on the surface. So we can go into things that are higher scaling environments. And all of those things are basically give us an edge. Now, in a traditional desalination environment, you know, when you look at the net process, that might be a 10 to 20% improvement over a traditional ion exchange membrane running a traditional desalination process. When you move into these harsh or extreme wastewaters, these membranes, they fall apart. And so in that case, you know, it's a night and day difference. You can't use the existing membranes. And so we have, in that sense, we're able to do something very differentiated in those spaces, which is where we tend to focus, because there's a lot of value in those spaces for being able to recover those water streams and that. So that's maybe how we segment it, is, you know, what everyone can do. We, you know, somewhere in that 10 to 20% improvement over the existing technology. If it's in the space that no one is working, yeah, obviously that's completely differentiated.
Conventional desalination, is there any value in terms of OPEX using your ceramic membrane compared to polymeric membrane?
I think that there, potentially, I think that hasn't been a space that we've spent much time, just because there's, you know, in conventional desalination, one of the things that people value a lot is the lack of risk that exists there, right? People have been using existing membranes, they work well, and no one wants a headache. Even if you can get a 20% improvement, you know, no one wants a headache. And so, and that's one thing that, like, with startups, we always are going to have that risk. And so often we haven't spent a whole lot of time in looking at those. I think in the long arc of Membreon, if you look at where we're at in 10 or 15 years from now, I think you'll see us more in a traditional desalination space. But right now it hasn't been our focus to really look at improving that space, because, you know, when we work with facilities that are paying $2 to $3 a gallon to truck their wastewater offsite, and we can help do that for a few cents per gallon to allow them to reuse that water, that's a super compelling value proposition. And so that's really where we focus, is on helping facilities in those ways where no other membrane can displace that trucking process. But lots of membranes can desalinate a water stream.
Right. And then I think one of the value also for you that you can access in desalination that the polymeric membrane is still struggling, which is a chlorine resistance membrane.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think, yeah, it's, if I understood correctly, it's stable in chlorine, the membrane.
It is. Yes. Yeah. Very stable. Yep. Yeah. So that's another advantage of that ceramic chemistry, is that we're a lot more stable under, in those environments. And so, yeah, it's certainly, we have some streams that, that are, you know, that is a unique differentiator, for the technology.
Right. And then looking to the polymeric membrane, when we look to, the desalination, we are talking about brackish water and seawater. And the polymeric membrane, I mean, they made them in a way, for brackish water, you have 98% rejection. And for seawater, you need to have high salt concentration. And the only difference is the module design. The module of seawater can be stable at high pressure. I think in your case, it does make difference, because you are not working with osmotic pressure. You are a completely different concept. But when it comes to the rejection, can you tear, really make your membrane 98, 99? I mean, can you play with this kind of rejection with your membrane?
We can. Yeah, we do have the ability to do things like tailor the rejection, tailor rejection of specific ions within that. Those are things that we can do. They're not things that we are... you know, we're having so much demand for the kind of core things that we focus on, that it's not something we're focused on today, but it's something that our R&D team is playing around with. But yeah, working in things like, you know, high concentration brines, we can get very good rejection, very high salt flux, and being able to reuse and capture water that otherwise is just too concentrated. So, you know, I think in some of the extreme cases, we're working with facilities that are, you know, above 50,000, even 100,000 ppm of TDS that's in there, and helping them be able to drop that down to a reusable level. The other thing that's really unique about electrodialysis is that, you know, RO, for example, is very much an all or nothing. It's great at that, right? Is that you're going to get very pure water out the back end. EDR, you can get a tunable product. So in a lot of cases, if you, for example, if you're looking to reuse your water, you don't actually need ultra pure water. You a lot of times just need it to be the same concentration as your feed of whatever is going into your initial system. And so in a lot of cases, we actually, you know, help the facilities get back to you know, something that they can blend into their feed water stream and then take through their existing processes and reduce the amount of feed water that they're having to pull from municipalities and things like that, because they're just getting more circularity within their system. And so a lot of that is where we really work with facilities to understand what is it that they actually need. Do they really need, you know, for example, sending RO quality water to a cooling tower can have challenges because it's so pure. And so really getting, you know, the right amount of ions in there for being able to maximize that value is the key.
Right. So can you give us also another applications where you it's kind of your core competency that you are working right now?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we're working, you know, we're working with a handful of different food and beverage companies on dealing with brine streams that have a modest amount of fouling in it. So, you know, we work with facilities that, you know, you might have a food wastewater, for example. So something that's used in brining foods or things like that. And you can actually, that have a reasonably high, you know, 100 ppm, 500 ppm of TOC in it. So that's something that's going to be really problematic for a traditional RO membrane or something like that. A lot of these wastewaters are trucked offsite to be, you know, disposed, boiled, precipitated elsewhere. And so what we're able to do with a lot of these facilities is, you know, they would prefer to discharge or reuse. But all the reason that they can't is because the TDS is too high. You know, it might be 5 or 10,000 ppm of TDS, and they need to reduce that down to a few hundred, for example, if they wanted to discharge it. And so what we can help them do is basically take that water that otherwise they're loading onto a truck and driving somewhere else to be treated. We can actually help them to treat that on site. And then they have to ship off is the 10% brine that we generate. So we reduce their trucking cost by 10x, which is obviously also a major sustainability benefit, because the fewer trucks on the road that are burning gasoline, just driving water around, is good for all of us. And so that's really where, you know, at applications like that, where you have, you know, fouling that exists but isn't problematic enough to warrant treatment. It can go down the drain from a TOC or an organic content side, but it can't from a TDS side. Those are streams that really lean into our value proposition because our membranes are low fouling. So you can run them in these high fouling environments while being able to drop the TDS on the back end.
There are a lot of applications in nutrition. When you say that, I'm just thinking about them, like in dairy, for instance, when you talk about infant BB milk powder, for instance, there's so many stuff can be done. Yep. And then, well, this brings me to the question, which is looking to your technology. One of the things that's hard for every technology to penetrate this market is you need to have FDA and I think another certificate. You don't need to use any toxic chemicals in your process.
Yep.
I would assume your technology does have this kind of certificate, FDA.
So we haven't had to get it yet because we often are focused on the wastewater side of things as opposed to the feed, you know, the process water side. It is something that within the next year we're going to go through the process. We've already started interacting with consultants for being able to kind of move through those FDA and NSF processes, but basically from our standpoint, you know, what we've got in our membranes is it's incredibly benign. You know, silica is a very standard material. Ion exchange materials have no problem getting through these certifications. So for us, it's a box to check, but not one we've had to check yet, because focusing on a lot of these extreme wastewaters, you know, they often will end up sending them to a cooling tower or something like that after we're finished with it to be reused. And so, but as we start to move more on the process side, yeah, I definitely think that's something that we'll need to do.
Right. And looking to your portfolio, just can you give us, an idea the size of the unit, how it looks like, and in terms of capacity, how much cubic meter or gallon per day can treat?
Yeah, so basically we have two different modules that we're selling today. One is it's about 18 inches by 24 inches. We'll process about 5 to 10 gallons per minute for that module. And then we've got another one that's about 2 feet by 4 feet tall. It'll do 25 to 50 gallons per minute. So those are the two that we're using. And so obviously smaller projects will use the smaller modules, bigger ones will use the bigger ones. From a capacity standpoint, for example, if you need 100 gallons per minute of treatment capacity on a stream, you would just run two or four of the big ones in parallel. So it's just like any other desalination module that you get up to capacity by running more in parallel.
So if I understand correctly, in terms of footprints, it's smaller in terms of capacity. I mean, it treats the same amount like the membrane, but it's smaller in size compared to the membrane.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Okay, because that makes a lot of advantage in offshore platform for oil and gas.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. There's a big, yeah, from a footprint standpoint, we tend to do quite well, which is helpful because often we're coming in as that process efficiency enhancer, right? So we're looking to just find a nice nook and cranny, and we're finding, in some of these sites, you really got to fit into some unique areas. But thankfully we're small, and so that really helps us on that front.
Yeah, and then just crazy. I mean, how did I have, which is in terms of yeah, I think your membrane, I think, yeah, you could backwash your membrane. There would be no problem to backwash the membrane. yeah
Correct.
yeah yeah could be no problem. Yeah, so one of my last question, which is what your team is working right now to solve, and why are they going to solve them?
Yeah. So, I think that are you thinking from a like a long-term vision, a short-term
Short
vision?
term,
What
just
short-term?
short term and long term. I mean, something that's really, they're struggling and it has a value, so that's the listeners, they will be prepared. There is some value that is coming that can be solved.
Absolutely. Yeah, one of the things that we're working on right now is dealing with cooling tower blowdowns. We've actually got a few different projects that we're running on that front, and we're seeing, we're now starting to do some work, and we're seeing very high cycles of concentration that we're able to generate for cooling towers, upwards of 20 cycles of concentration with no chemical use in these. And so we're looking at some of these applications, both large and small volume cooling towers, where we're able to generate significant value for the end user and reduced water consumption, reduced chemical consumption on that front, which is really where a lot of facilities are moving. Often when we talk with the facilities, one of the first things we hear from people is like, "Can you do anything on cooling towers? Like, I'm sitting at 3 cycles of concentration. What can you do to get me up?" And we're proving that we can see that 70, 80, 90% reduction in water consumption for cooling towers by leveraging our technology. Handle a lot of the polymers, the additives, the things that are in cooling towers. We can handle them very effectively. So that's, I think, an area that we're really leaning into that fits the value proposition really well because they're mineral rich. There's scaling. They're challenging, but we're able to treat them quite effectively. And I think that that's going to be a space that we're able to do some really big things.
Cool. I mean, if in the so-called, in terms of temperature, your membrane, it's not gets annealing. It doesn't be affected with temperature. So the flux or the permeance over your membrane, it's not changing if you go up to 80 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, we aren't seeing because we have a fixed pore size, we have a much more stable flux as a function of temperature. Exactly.
Yeah. But the molecule weight cutoff for your membrane?
So for ours, basically everything that we're doing is Ionic. Those are the things that we're going to remove. And so that's one of the things that we often, again, why we pair well with other technologies, because, you know, for example, we're not going to do nanofiltration. We're not going to knock out organics or things like that. We are just going to remove the ionic components that are in there. And so that definitely, you know, and that that's an EDR concept more than a membrane concept. All electrodialysis is that way. But that's why we really focus on pairings with the right technology to make sure that we hit the treatment targets.
Right. And while pairing with the right technology, which kind of minimum infrastructure does your technology need in order to be in place with other technologies?
Yeah, usually the most frequent pairing is, you know, we'll have cartridge filters and things like that on the front end. Sometimes, depending on what's coming in, you may need a UF, but not often. But that's really where, you know, for us, when we look at pairings of tech, we're often thinking more the downstream, you know, what do we pair well with? Well, you know, if you're leveraging thermal processes, if you're leveraging resins, if you're leveraging chemical precipitation clarification processes as downstream, that we often are a significant efficiency enhancer for those technologies. And upstream, you know, there's the biological treatments, staff, things like that, that we can have some impact on not needing to necessarily take organics all the way out while still being able to drop TDS on the back end. So some on the front end of us, some on the back end of us that we can pair very nicely with.
Cool. The way how it's done in the water, space or in the water markets is like you have OEMs, you have like system builder, a company who build the system, and you have component supplier, company who supply the membrane. And the system builder, they try to screen all the membrane available in the markets to find the right membrane that can treat the right applications like in wastewater. So in your case, how does it work? Do you take the application, you upscale it from the problem to the real world, or there is another system builder that can take your membrane and use it for their systems?
Yeah, we'll work with people, you know, OEMs and system integrators who will deploy our membranes. So yeah, that's one thing about Membrion is we don't sell systems. So we allow people to use their preferred systems. You know, we've got some partnerships in place that we'll be able to announce here pretty soon. But we've got, basically we work with people to get these systems fully deployed in the field, and it allows people to use you know, reputable companies that have been around for a long time doing these things well.
Greg, super, very, very interesting. I mean, an inspiring really concept. I mean, I'm looking forward to really to see you on the real world in Aquatech, maybe in Amsterdam, and to have a look on your technology. And my last question is because water resin right now is like the problem for the whole world, and there will be no enough startup company or entrepreneur that can solve the water treatment. So what is your takeaway that you can give it to young people who are coming up to the entrepreneurial path in the water space?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things that we, you know, I think the World Economic Forum released a briefing that you know, demand for new water treatment solutions is way outpacing the current innovation that exists there. So, you know, the scale, the magnitude of the problem that exists, and it's getting exponentially worse year over year as we're moving towards climate-induced droughts and things like that, where, you know, we need solutions, you know, yesterday. And we need new innovations yesterday. And so I think that it's one of the places that it's exciting and impactful on a global scale to be able to bring technologies forward. So absolutely, like I think it is the space to be in is in the water treatment, because there's a million problems to solve. You know, we're tackling one small piece of it, but there's so many others that are needed as part of the bigger picture as we solve these problems. So
thanks a lot. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks.